From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Speeches, rhetoric, and smear campaigns, just another day in election paradise. But beyond all that lie the issues. What do you want from government, and how do the candidates plan to help the nation? Today, we're going to begin the first installment of Campaign Issues 101, where we pick apart key ideas in the campaigns of the presidential candidates and see how they stack up next to each other. Today, we tackle healthcare, and with me here to help is Paul Ginsberg. He's president of the Center for Studying Healthcare System Change. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
So, without going into the candidates just yet, what is it that Americans want from the healthcare system? There's been a lot of critics and a lot of proposals. What do you get a sense of in terms of trends of what Americans want to see in the federal government and healthcare?
Well, I think there are two things that are really motivating voters this time around. A lot of people are worried about their being able to afford health insurance in the future because costs are rising so fast and a lot faster than their incomes. And so this has brought an issue that was last really strong in the early 1990s about expanding health insurance coverage. But it's really very linked with the cost issue because I think many people recognize that it's rising costs that are causing the problem. So unless the candidates have a solution to rising costs, some of their terrific ideas for expanding coverage may fall short.
Let's focus in on families. If you were, I won't say the typical, because it is not the typical family, but the kind of prototypical family with mother, father, two kids, what kind of choices should you be looking at, or what kind of decision-making process should you be looking at when you evaluate the healthcare plans that are coming from the politicians?
Well, as far as their concepts.
Exactly.
I think what you should be evaluating is, are they offering something that'll ensure that you can buy coverage? And there really are two aspects to that. If you have low income, then the issue is, will you be covered by their subsidies or will you be eligible for public insurance under their plan? But if you don't have a connection with employer-based coverage, I think you're very concerned about reforms to the individual health insurance market. In other words, even if you get a subsidy, you don't want to go into a market where they might say, sorry, you have a pre-existing condition. We won't cover that, or we won't sell you coverage at all because your medical history is unfavorable. So in a sense, it's not only being subsidized, but it's the ability to buy coverage at a reasonable price. And, ironically, the Republican candidates tend to stress use of the individual insurance market more than the Democratic candidates. They're not expanding public programs. They are offering tax subsidies to use the individual insurance market, but they haven't, followed through with a plan about how are they going to make the individual market a less expensive and more reliable and viable source for buying coverage. And the Democrats have actually put forward proposals to set up insurance exchanges or something like the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program to really provide a working market where people can have confidence that if they can afford a reasonable cost for insurance, that they won't be excluded from that marketplace.
Is there a difference in what families with children might look for as opposed to families without children or individuals without children? And of course, one thing I should mention is that not everyone votes their self-interest in a strict way. If someone says, well, I'm single, but I really care about what happens to other people's children, that may also affect their decision making. But let's say that you were being completely focused on your best deal that you could get from politicians. If you're someone with no kids or no kids under the age of 18, what might you be looking for?
I'm not sure that it makes much difference whether you have children or not, except to the extent that, we've had a history of policy which has made public coverage more readily available to children than it has to adults. So, you know, the income limits for the SCHIP program are higher than the income limits for Medicaid, and all children from low-income families are eligible for that, whereas, you know, adults without children are not eligible for Medicaid in many states. Actually, some of the Democratic proposals might actually do more for low-income childless adults because it would give them the eligibility for public programs that they haven't had so far. There's actually more of a consensus throughout the nation about the virtues of ensuring coverage for children. And as a result, you know, a much higher percentage of children have coverage today than is the case for adults.
What about the issue of a business owner? There are some differences in how the Republicans and Democrats approach businesses' obligations towards individuals and also the tax credits that businesses might be able to get. If you are a business owner, what kind of questions should you be asking?
Well, that would depend on whether I offer insurance or not. And let's start with, say, the small business that does not offer insurance. And there are probably some things about the Democratic plans that they won't be happy about because, you know, there is a requirement to make coverage available and something to pay if you don't. Now, you know, saying that, that's part of the Massachusetts program where the amount that employers pay is really pretty limited and is not slated to become very large. In contrast, the Governor Schwarzenegger's plan in California, which you know, was defeated in committee in the state Senate, I guess a month ago, that had a much larger burden for employers. Now, moving on to, say, if you're a large employer and you know, virtually all large employers provide coverage in the United States today and have for a long time, they'll be watching very carefully at the changes in the tax treatment of employer-provided health insurance that are being proposed, particularly by Senator McCain, who, in a sense, would take the current exclusion of employer provided health insurance from employee incomes and turn it into a series of tax credits. So if you're an employer that is providing very deluxe coverage and you're in a high-cost area as far as health care, some of these benefits you're providing employees may no longer be tax-free. So you won't be happy about that. On the other hand, if you're providing less expensive, less extensive coverage or in a low-cost area, perhaps your employees will get some benefits compared to where things are today.
How big of an issue is the debate over public insurance, whether it's single-payer or other forms of public insurance? I mean, for example, when you look at the Republican candidates and the Democratic candidates, the Republican candidates generally are looking at ways of using market forces for private health care insurance. Both of the Democratic candidates have some plans, different plans, to put more public insurance into the mix. Is that just a fundamental party difference?
Yes. Actually, what's striking is how nobody, or at least none of the major candidates, are advocating single-payer systems today. I think the Democrats, and I'm talking about, you know, Clinton and Obama, really are taking their cues from Massachusetts, because Massachusetts 2 years ago was able to put together a political compromise that everyone got behind and that all the stakeholders got behind, which was a mixture of expanding public programs for low-income people like the Medicaid program and the SCHIP program, together with subsidies for, you know, low-income but somewhat better-off people to purchase private insurance. And I've always thought that setting the stage for this round was this compromise between an expansion of public programs and more subsidies for private coverage.
SCHIP is the Children's Insurance Program that became a huge political fight between the administration and Congress, the Democrats in Congress particularly, is something like SCHIP, which provides insurance specifically for children, something that the candidates generally agree on across party lines, or how does that play out?
Yes, well, I suspect that most candidates would be in favor of at least continuing CHIP, but the Democratic candidates would like to expand it as far as their plans for universal coverage. What really surprised people in this SCHIP controversy between the president and the Democrats in Congress was that it came up because many people, I would say, going 6 months back, felt that there would be ultimately a compromise that involved expansions of Medicaid and SCHIP and more subsidies, usually through the tax system for private insurance. But it may have been that the president didn't want the starting point to develop this compromise to be a much expanded CHIP program from where it is today. In a sense, he may have just wanted to keep it where it is, and then perhaps Republicans and Democrats would compromise from where it is today rather than from a greatly expanded program.
Well, Paul, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Pleasure.
Paul Ginsberg is president of the Center for Studying Healthcare System Change, and he joined me from NPR DC headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. With digital technology, shooting video footage is easier and cheaper than ever, but making something of it and reaching the right audience is still a huge challenge. Today, we continue our series on African Americans in film with a look at independent documentaries. We've got two filmmakers who chose hip-hop as their focus. Raquel Cepeda is an award-winning editor and multimedia journalist. Her documentary is Bling: A Planet Rock.
Wow, yeah. I got my mouth looking something like a disco ball. Yeah. I got the diamonds in the ice, all hands set. I might cause a cold front if I take a deep breath.
I mean, diamonds affect a lot of people a lot of different ways. A lot of people that I grew up around, they, you know, the hustlers, they all wore the diamonds. All the gangsters had the gold teeth, you know what I'm saying? So that's just naturally, that's what I always wanted.
Byron Hurt is an activist and filmmaker. He produced and directed the documentary Hip Hop, Beyond Beats and Rhymes.
Through rap music, I think there's an identification with some of the most stereotypical masculine standards.
Every black man that goes in the studio, he's always got two people in his head. Him, in terms of who he really is, and the thug that he feels he has to project. It's a prison for us.
One of the things we've been doing with our film series is talking about what we see on screen and what it takes to get it there. Raquel told us about the inspiration for her movie.
Well, I've always been interested in the international hip-hop scene, and I always wanted to bring a fresh approach to the way hip-hop was being covered. And actually, I don't see Bling: A Planet Rock as being an independent film, but more of a mainstream film, because it's hip-hop, and hip-hop is mainstream. And, you know, it happened from there. It took about 7 years.
Raquel, if you had to sum up what your doc is about in casual conversation with someone who knew nothing about hip-hop, what would you say?
I would say that Bling: A Planet Rock is a feature documentary about hip-hop's obsession with bling and diamonds and materialism and how that affected another group of generation hip-hop-ites, if that's even a word, in Sierra Leone, West Africa, during a war.
A lot of people say it's more important things you could be rapping about. It's more substance. You know, there's no substance in diamonds. But I look at it the exact opposite. You know, it's a lot of substance in diamonds because, you know, when you overcome the struggle, really being from poverty to success, some people is, you know, a lot of girls. But for me, you know what I'm saying, my substance growing up was always just to have some diamonds around my neck, some diamonds in my mouth, and a family, and have my family with some diamonds.
Byron, let me turn to you. In your film, you're not just talking about hip-hop, you're also talking about the construction of masculinity. How did you come to approach it that way?
Well, for years, I had done a lot of work working with boys and men, educating them around sexism and men's violence against women, and also just doing a lot of introspective work about myself and my own ideas and my own construction of masculinity. And so learning about those issues made me think a lot more critically about the music that I was listening to and the music that was quickly becoming youth culture. And so I decided that I wanted to make a film that focused on masculinity in hip-hop. And sort of deconstructed the gender representations of manhood in the music and in the music videos.
Before hip-hop, men were seeming in R&B, they was like very docile, you know what I mean? But when hip-hop came around, it brought masculinity back into the game. Now, some of it is a little misguided.
One second we're killing each other, the next minute we're pimping hoes. We're doing everything wrong. Us bananas.
What was the hardest sequence for you to film?
I went down to Daytona Beach to shoot the BET's annual Spring Bling, or it's also known as Black College Weekend, and I was denied press credentials to get backstage access. And so I had to figure out something else to shoot. And so I decided to focus on hip-hop fans who came down to attend the event. And, you know, it was just a really crazy scene where a lot of the, you know, the young men who came down were really treating women in very, you know, very objectified ways, disrespectful ways. And it was just a real crazy scene. What it showed, what it revealed about black masculinity and what it also may have reinforced about some negative and stereotypical images of black men.
You know, what you raise is something that that a lot of people face. It's like, do I show the whole truth or do I hide the dirty laundry? Did you ever feel like, you know what, I'm betraying people by showing them, even just doing what they're doing? It sounds like you had some conflict about that.
Well, I did, but I talked to a lot of really good people who I get advice from and support, and just told that I was doing the right thing by revealing something that really doesn't get enough discussion. But from my perspective, as somebody who has done anti-sexist work and work to educate boys and men about sexism and violence against women, to me, it was critical to cover that scene.
Raquel, when you think about your audience for the film, you talk about it as a mainstream film that is still finding all of its the different parts of its audience. What do people say to you once they've seen your film? How do they process what you've done?
You know, it's really interesting to see just how different and how, like, wide range my demographic is, because, you know, there's so many different topics that I'm dealing with in the film. It's not only hip-hop, but really it's about a lot of other things, about, you know, global empathy, about child soldiers, about the way, you know, the weight that hip-hop lyrics have around the world, and just exposing, you know, rappers to that.
What was the most interesting part of filming Americans in Sierra Leone, famous Americans? What did you get out of, you know, from your perspective as a filmmaker, out of watching the scene, not just through the lens, but overall as you took that trip?
When I first started it, I figured that, you know, I want everything to be very neat. Like, you know, Teo Calderon, he's Puerto Rican, and I wanted him to represent, you know, because I'm from the Dominican Republic, I want him to represent, you know, the Latinos that really embrace their, you know, Pan-Africanism and that side of their heritage. You know, Raekwon, I figured that he would have had, like, a very personal homecoming, and I thought that Paul Wall maybe, because not only because, you know, he was a white guy, but because he also was in the diamond business, that he wouldn't find himself, he wouldn't see himself in, you know, in Sierra Leone. But I just found it, from a personal perspective, to have come out so differently than what I went in thinking.
Let me move on to you, Byron. How has your film lived after the production, after the airings on television? Where does it live now in terms of using it for outreach or education? What are you doing with it?
It's been phenomenal. The film has had a lot of legs. I've been traveling with the film on the road for the last 2 years. There have been screenings at colleges and high schools, and the film has been used and is being used all over the country and all over the world as an educational resource and a tool. It's being used by local and national organizations that deal with the multiple or myriad issues that I address in the film. I see myself as more than a filmmaker. I see myself as an activist and somebody who uses film to push people's awareness and consciousness.
Raquel, how do you see yourself?
I'm just a writer, filmmaker, editor, just trying to make, you know, produce content that's going to challenge people and challenge stereotypes and just, you know, maybe bridge the gap between hip-hop generation, hip-hop heads all over the world and America.
Byron, how do you think that the digital nature of filming today has changed what you were able to do?
Well, I think it has changed it drastically, and I'm still learning, you know, what it means for me as a filmmaker and what it's going to mean for me and other filmmakers in the future. But I think that now we're at a point where pretty much anybody can make a film. I mean, you got kids who can make a film using iMovie or iDVD or, you know, their whatever computer software programs that they have. You know, the real big question, though, is, you know, how do you get a large audience? How do you sustain a large audience? How do you bring people to, you know, your website or wherever you house your content to get people to watch and pay attention? But I think that for me, it seems like it makes making films easier. But I think the thing is, you still have to have a really strong story and a strong sense of storytelling in order for, you know, anybody to really seriously consider your film.
Raquel, you and Byron both have streaming video or embedded video available on the websites, and that alone seems to change the way that people can immediately access what you do. What's been the most important thing for you about shooting and distributing in the digital age?
Well, I'm still learning, you know, about it myself, and I totally agree and second everything that Byron said. And I think it's great that it's, you know, that now we're empowering a lot of, you know, anybody can tell a story. And it's really interesting because it's making the world smaller, and we're learning more. We're learning more about different cultures around the world because of this, access. And I'm still, you know, learning about digital filmmaking myself, but, you know, I kind of like the old-fashioned way. I like going with my cameras, and I like, you know, sifting through and logging and you know, really discussing every single clip with my editor. You know, I like the pain. I don't know what it is.
I do too.
I like it.
I do too, Raquel. I don't know what that is. We must be crazy.
Yes. I'm a little scared of the digital stuff, but I think it's really cool. Really cool to be able to go online any day, any time, and just learn about people, learn about cultures, and just see stuff. You know, it's great.
Well, what would you guys say, and I'm going to start with you, Raquel, there are a lot of people who are out there shooting in an ad hoc basis. That is not going to produce a documentary necessarily, even though it might give you the seed of it. So for somebody who, say, has gone and shot one interview and was like, you know, I can make something of this, what would you tell them to do as a next step?
Well, it depends on what the interview is about, but really research. Think about it, you know, see how other people have covered, you know, the same subject. You know, like I'm doing right now, my next film is on Vietnam and Iraq through a hip-hop lens, going to the past to, you know, really see where we're going to be at in the future with this, because, you know, with this invasion that we did in Iraq. And I'm using Vietnam as an example, but I have to sit here, and I've been doing months and months of research of how everybody else has covered the Vietnam War and has covered Iraq and has covered all these other things. So, you know, it's really, really about research and interviewing people. And, you know, even if you don't shoot them, just, you know, really, really trying to, like, build a file so that, you know, you're really well equipped to tell your story with confidence.
What about you, Byron? Advice?
Well, I'm a big proponent of, you know, making sure that you commit your ideas to paper and, you know, just really follow through on your ideas. And if you have an interview, if you started out with one interview in the can, one interview doesn't make a film. You know, you have to build, you know, a group of storytellers or characters in your film, and you have to figure out a way that you're going to tell a story in a way that flows and that has a structure and that makes sense and that is engaging and that is intelligent and smart, and if you want to make an intelligent and smart film. So, you know, I think that the biggest thing to being a successful filmmaker is to really sort of stick with it and to be very, very persistent and, you know, just follow through, you know, because there are a lot of different things that come up in your personal life and even in your professional life that will deter you if you allow it to. So I think you have to be very focused. You have to be very clear on what you want. You have to be single-minded and you have to be determined. You have to have a dog. You have to be doggedly determined to make your film. And so, you know, I was listening to Raquel. She said it took her 7 years to make her film. It took me 6 years to make my film. So these things don't happen overnight if you want to do them well. And, you know, it really takes a lot of commitment. One of the things my father told me before he passed away, he said, if you want to be a filmmaker, then you have to be committed to it. And those words really stuck in my mind whenever I faced a challenge or whenever I was getting a little disappointed or down on myself or doubtful or lacked confidence or whatever. You know, being committed is what kind of brought me through.
Well, Raquel, because of the kind of audience that you have a reach to and because of the kind of people you're able to get from the hip hop world, there's a lot of people debate, well, how much should I partner with corporations? Would you ever consider partnering with a big music company or something like that in order to reach more people? Or do you have possible ethical conflicts with that? How does that play out in what you do?
No, I mean, I wouldn't go with Monsanto, you know, but I would definitely go or with Halliburton. But, you know, with a music company or, you know, I would, it depends on who the corporation is. I mean, you know, I want to get the story out there. And if they're not going to get involved in it, you know, that's really a broad, I mean, it would really, really depend on who the corporation was. And like, for example, somebody who co-starred in my film, Ishmael Bea, he has a book called, you know, A Long Way Gone. It's an international bestseller. And it's an important story that he told, that he shared with us. But I don't think that it would have done so well if Starbucks hadn't backed it.
Right.
And now it's become an international bestseller, and it's being translated into into so many different languages. And, you know, that's a greater good, even though you can criticize Starbucks for all, you know, I'm sure, for a number of things. I think that, you know, that outweighed. But now if Halliburton came and wanted to give me money or, you know, Blackwater or somebody, of course I'd say no. So it really depends on the situation. But I don't see, you know, generally speaking, I think that a lot of production companies are doing that.
Byron, when you think about the future projects that you might undertake, how do you make that calculus? You know, a lot of people, when they discuss what's real and what's not real, make judgments about, well, how underground is it? You know, who's putting money into it? How do you make those decisions?
Well, I have to admit, I want to reach the largest audience that I possibly can, you know, as a filmmaker. You know,
right,
I want as many people to see my film as humanly possible. I see my audience as being the world, you know, not one particular target audience or that sort of thing. So I think if it sits right with me, if it feels good to me, if I feel like I'm not making any strong moral or ethical compromises, then I would be interested in doing it. As long as I had the type of creative control that I desired and I could really flex my muscles as a filmmaker and deliver the content that I want to deliver. It's very difficult to escape the fact that, you know, we live in a world where only a handful of media conglomerates control the media. And so I think that you have to sort of invade the media with content that resembles what everybody sees on a daily basis, but is subversive in terms of the message, or at least is something that, you know, pushes people's awareness and makes people think critically. That's what I'm about as a filmmaker. That's how I want to be as a filmmaker. You know, I was inspired by filmmakers like Marlon Riggs and, you know, Orlando Bagwell and Henry Hampton and Kathy Sandler, you know, people who made films, documentary films that pushed my awareness and made me see social issues from a different perspective. So that's how I want to be as a filmmaker. And I want to be very smart and very sophisticated and very crafty at how I reach my audience.
Raquel and Byron, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you again, Farai. I haven't seen you in a long time.
I know.
Spoken to you.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, too.
Much love. Much
yes,
love and respect.
Please.
All right. Thanks for having me. I appreciate
okay.
it.
That was filmmaker and activist Byron Hurt. His latest documentary is Hip Hop, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And editor and multimedia journalist Raquel Cepeda. Her documentary is Bling, A Planet Rock. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. When you think of Martha's Vineyard, you might get an image of the Kennedy family hosting a clam bake. But there's also been a significant black population living there since the colonial days. A new play called Stickfly takes us into the family parlor to visit with a father, two sons, and the three women in their lives. It hits issues from interracial relationships to what it means to be a man.
Not only is it problematic that we haven't stopped to consider racial tensions in our now female-dominated society, but we haven't even begun to consider class.
I'm not sure that class matters.
Son, I raised you better than that. This house has been full of octoroons and quadroons for three generations, and you think our loving white neighbors wouldn't rather we move over to the bluffs with the other Negroes? Cheryl, Could you top me off, please, dear? You can just leave the bottle, thanks.
Stickfly airs tomorrow on public radio stations and on XM Radio as part of the LA Theater Works series The Play's the Thing. Director Shirley Jo Finney and actors Carl Lumbly and Dulé Hill join me in studio to talk about what it means to perform for radio and the big issues the play tackles.
To me, the play is about love and preserving the family, bottom line. Even though they talk about the socioeconomics, they talk about race, and there's all these different layers. But what happens, because all families have some type of secret, but what happens when you discover a lie and a betrayal? What happens to that structure? The structure, be it a house, but also the structure of your body temple. And I think for me, that's the important thing about it's the base, the root. Don't you agree, Carl?
I do. In fact, I think that part of what I was drawn to was also the fact that people have different positions in families, and the difference between the way a father can love and the way a mother is allowed to love can sometimes be very, very difficult for children. I think father love has to leave out certain aspects of nurturing and go for a tougher kind of a stance in terms of preparing people, especially young men, for making their way into the world. And then the position you have to take, sort of putting yourself on a pedestal, is one that as time moves on and your children move to adulthood, you may be toppled off just by nature of the fact that the truth is not always harmonious.
A lot of folks know you from your television roles, Psych, mm-hmm. West Wing. How's it different? I mean, this is a real interesting hybrid because you have a stage play, which people, including me, are seeing, and then you have the radio aspect. How do you play with those dynamics as an actor?
The radio experience really is all about the words,
mm-hmm.
which I said it's enjoyable to do because it's all about the words. Everything you do comes through the piece of dialogue you say. It's not about the air in between. It's all about putting it into the words. And
it's really facilitating, because first there was the word. So that it's really facilitating mm-hmm. the writer.
Mm-hmm.
Carl, what do you think of that kind of hybridity?
Well, I love it because I think it's just another way to express your skill set.
I think it's very similar to what we're doing now with you, why people will listen to you. I think the voice carries the spirit. And you can tell when someone is lying just by the tone of the voice.
Yeah. Flip's girl's a little melanin challenged.
Melanin challenged?
She's of the other persuasian.
Oh, not in the tribe, huh?
Look, she's cool. Studies race dynamics in inner city schools.
As opposed to the outer city?
Oh, she white.
She's Italian.
Class dynamics. The class dynamics in this play are hilarious. The fact that the two sons bring home two different women from two different branches of intelligent female companionship that may not always sit well with the family is hilarious. Tell me about Kent's fiance,
Taylor.
What is there not to say about him? Taylor is just a bag of, because of what's going on inside her, she likes to be the center of attention, or at least in the midst of it all. She can never just sit on the sideline and observe. Taylor will push me in the direction that I want to go in terms of writing and all of my artistic dreams when my father won't give me that.
I think each of the character is trying to find placement, trying to find sense of self. And the illusion of father and his boundaries and the illusion of the world of structure. And here comes Taylor in this house for one weekend, and she's just buzzing around, mm-hmm. affecting all of these people's lives, and it starts to unravel, and the secret starts to come apart.
And this is great-great-grandfather Whitcomb, the great sea captain.
He's so handsome.
Yeah, I got his good looks.
Yeah, I've seen this picture before.
Yeah, in your dad's book.
Of course.
Captain Whitcomb was never a slave. He was a shipper.
Of what?
We don't talk about that. Anyway, he saved the mayor's son from a boating accident. As a reward, the mayor gave him this land on which he built this house, making the Whitcombs the first blacks to own land anywhere on the vineyard.
Well, Carl, talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the class dynamics, because there are all these puzzle boxes of secrets that unfold, but you have all these tensions about what does it mean to be black? What does it mean to be rich and black? What does it mean to be light-skinned, dark-skinned, all this stuff? What do you like most about the different aspects that get played with in this work?
Well, one of the things I think I like most about the piece is that there are two women who are never seen who play as large a part in this piece as all of the people who are there. And I think that's part of what, the class dynamic in this piece has to do with people who have place in this vineyard situation. They have something that they don't have outside of this place. Now, no matter how rich the LaVeys may be, they will never have the same class, quote unquote, that they would have in the white world. But here on the vineyard, they are top of the heap. And poor Joseph has married into the top of the heap. So even he, with all of his neurosurgeon monies, is still not class enough for the Whitcomb family.
Which is old guard money.
Exactly.
Old guard black money.
Yes, exactly.
Old guard black money.
Right. And I just want to iterate too, so there's this play takes place in the summer, 3 days on Martha's Vineyard, where the family has a summer home. They went to the vineyard because they could be themselves. You know, even though we are privileged and we work in the world and we're the doctors and the lawyers and the Indian chiefs and corporate America, et cetera, and having to navigate mainstream America, when they went to the vineyard, they were social. They had interrelationships with their own. So it was that place of safety and comfort.
What about the concepts of manhood? Carl was talking a little bit earlier about the idea of father love versus mother love. Do you believe that it seems to me that during this play, there's a lot of discussion of what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a husband? What does it mean to be a father? And it also seems like a very important time to talk about those issues in our society when you have people like Bill Cosby discussing the impact. What do you think of the dialogue between the two brothers who have very different outlooks on what does it mean to be a man? Does it mean to do right economically? Does it mean to do right in terms of fidelity? Does it mean to do right emotionally?
My son at 19 arrived post-feminism. That was very, very important in his development. My father, pre-feminism, very different way of articulating manhood. And I think in many ways, because my experience spans both, I got the best of both. I think Kent is comparable to me in terms of the way men have been taught to be. And I think the difference between Kent, Spoon, and Flip, who is
the
Joe LaVey's older son, is that Joe could be more of a sibling with his older son, and he could cultivate more of the idea of reputation. Kent, because of his development, he's not as interested in reputation. He wants to treat women respectfully, and he has a sensitivity that he's very conversant with. It's a large part of who he is to the world.
But it doesn't seem as if Dr. LaVey's character respects that sensitivity.
Well, he fears it because I believe that's the whole thing about being sensitive. You want your sons to succeed in the world. And one of the big criticisms that Joe LaVey has about Kent is he's too soft. And as a soft black male, you may get badly, badly hurt.
Yeah. I'm 15, and all I want, like every other 15-year-old boy, is to have a cute girl like me, maybe get to second base. But I'm thinking I can't because I've got some sort of, I don't know, testosterone deficiency. My daddy made me think that. Why? Because I give a shit about people? Because I don't put myself first? Because I hear what women say and actually like them for it?
It was the same criticism that my father had for me. You're too soft.
Yeah.
What will happen when you meet adversity? And what I think that generation didn't understand is that there is a tremendous supple strength that is gained when you have both your manhood and a sense of femininity in hand. I think in this play especially, Joseph LeVay is most thrilled at the end of the piece by the fact that he understands now that Kent speaks truth to power. And in a black family, man to man, son to father, that was not an easy thing to do. I remember when I did it, my father and I didn't speak for quite some time. But now, in this piece, by speaking truth to power, he changes what his father thinks about him. Breaking and it's cycle. A moment of pride. Maybe not the moment of pride that Joseph LeVay thought he was going to get. It's far greater than that, because he suddenly now realizes just how strong his son is.
Well, Shirley Jo, on a last note, and this may be a strange last note, are you the puppeteer? It doesn't seem as if being a director in this case is like being a puppeteer. It seems like you have some very...
I call myself a conductor.
There you go.
That's what I do. I conduct. I listen to the music, the emotional music that actors play, because that's their notes. And then when I read the score, it's my playwright's words. And I have to give voice. I have to make sure that I cast the right instruments and in the voicing so that you can take this journey. And the journey, we're told, I know it's crazy and I'm non sequitur and fragmented, but it's the drum. What is the drum? What rhythm of the drum does this piece have?
Well, Shirley Jo, Carl Dulay, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We were talking to director Shirley Jo Finney and actors Carl Lumbly and Dulay Hill. Stickfly airs tomorrow on public radio stations and XM Radio as part of the LA Theater Works series, The Play's the Thing. We're wrapping up this Friday show with a slice of life called Snapshots. Commentator Jeff Obafemi Carr swerves down that tricky N-word highway and finds it packed with potholes and brotherly love.
The other day, I got called a I can't say that on the radio. Well, I got called
the N-word.
But it's not what you might think. I try to attend my college's homecoming game every year. I went to an HBCU. Thousands of black folks gathered for fun and fond remembrances. I got to the game and ran into people left and right. I made it to a spot under the scoreboard in the fourth quarter, and I saw a cat I used to hang with. He greeted me warmly with the familiar phrase, "What's up, my..."
The N-word.
I was instantly put at a crossroads. Knowing this cat, I know it was an appellation of endearment, something we all may have said behind closed doors just a few years ago. But now,
the N-word
is under criticism, like no time since its inception as a racial slur countless generations ago. I'm not defending the use of
the N-word.
I'd be a fool to. But I have to be honest. Many of us, from kids in the street to rappers to even old school community leaders, use
the N-word
in casual conversation. How many times have we heard the following phrases, even from so-called professionals? Man, that
the N-word
must be out of his mind. That
the N-word
thinks he's better than everybody else in his office because he got a promotion. If they say one more thing to me, they're gonna find out that I'm the wrong
the N-word
to mess with. I even heard a good PhD buddy of mine sum up Reverend Sharpton's political run in simple barbershop terms when he said, "I don't care if the social political atmosphere creates the possibility of a black president or not. I know one thing. I'm not going to vote for it."
The N-word.
With a perm. The other issue here is, with all the current publicity surrounding
the N-word,
including national debates, spoken word pieces, and even a funeral to officially bury it, it's growing in prominence more because we're saying the code phrase,
the N-word,
repeatedly, as if it's okay to use that term instead. Doesn't that defeat the purpose? Shouldn't we just be forgetting the word? Now when you say
the N-word,
only small children don't know what you mean, and they invariably ask the question, "What is the N-word?" Then you have to go into actually using the term anyway to describe why you shouldn't say it. All the while, Classrooms of older teens are using the old argument that it's a term of endearment when another black person uses it, but fighting words if someone else does. Any way you look at it, I think it's safe to say that
the N-word
isn't headed toward extinction anytime soon. I'd venture to say that some of the same people who attended
the N-word's
funeral at some point let it slip out of their mouths. But as is always the case, we tend to put on a front in public, or as Paul Lawrence Dunbar said, we wear the mask that grins and lies. So is it really
the N-word
that makes us angry? Or is it the intent behind the word? I've been referred to as a soul brother by a white person, and it wasn't meant in a loving sense at all. I thought about all that as my friend awaited me with open arms. I was going to tell him about the funeral of
the N-word
and how that term was taboo now. Or maybe say
the N-word.
Don't call me that, man. I realized, though, when he grabbed me, he was calling me his
the N-word
with all the love a brother can show another. So instead, I hugged him back, laughed, and decided to give him a pass on using
the N-word
that night. One thing was for sure. I'd rather be his
the N-word
than anyone else's.
Jeff Obafemi Carr is an actor, playwright, and co-host of the radio show Freestyle. He lives in Nashville, Tennessee.